Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
This is News Talk.
Yes, this is Alive and Kicking, News Talk's health and wellness show. I'm Claire McKenna. Coming up, it's described as one of the most natural things in the world, but why is breastfeeding such a controversial topic? I'll be joined by a lactation expert and also a mum. And also on the show today, the pileup of bills and not making enough money can be a massive strain on your mental health. I'm going to be joined by Dr. Mark Harold and ask him, what can you do to balance not only the books, but then your brain? And I'll be joined by Claire McGrath. It's very hard not to run into Claire McKenna there. Claire McGrath is Ireland's first female IFBB fitness pro athlete. She's a serious bodybuilder, that's what that title means, but she's also a yoga master, having studied it in India, and she's one very impressive individual. I'll also have a chance for you to win a Fitbit Versus with thanks to the Great Pink Run, so stay listening for that. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, I have to say it was a good one for Claire this week. I had two nights in Lisbon without the kids with my husband for our wedding anniversary, so that was very good for the soul. And then I got to recover from those two evenings at a spa day. I was invited to the launch of Aquasana at Centre Parks, so that was a lovely float around day. It is, they say, Ireland's biggest spa, so there's 21 different rooms for me to float myself around. So that was a lovely lounging day and more time to myself. And I must say, on the back of all of that, yesterday was one of the most productive days I have ever had. It involved house cleaning, house sorting, batch cooking, there were washes going, there was freezers getting filled up. So I do believe, as I always say, as I was making jewellery in the evening with my six-year-old daughter, time away really can make you a better mum and a better person, I believe. And in news this week, what did you make of the story that Ireland is joining an international campaign for a four-day working week? Would you be in favour of it? Now, the work-life balance is something that we hear talked about a lot, and I do think it's something that many struggle with, particularly if you have families where now both parents are working, because that's the norm nowadays. And if it's a 9-to-5 setup, it can involve long commutes, creche fees, and not only that, but sort of dropping kids off early in the morning, picking them up late at night and or late in the evening, and not having enough family time or downtime. And it does have a negative impact on all involved. Many make it work and don't know any different, don't get me wrong, but I do think that even if you don't have kids, working less has to have a universal appeal. Now, I have been freelance for about 5 years now, and I do still have plenty of work and get busy. It's on a more flexible basis. So while it does have its disadvantages, I never really know where I'm meant to be at any one time. Every time the alarm goes off, I have to spend a little bit of time saying, where am I going? What am I supposed to be doing? And I can never really hook on to any kind of routine, which I think as humans, we like a routine. It would take something massive for me to spend a massive block of time doing the same thing week in, week out for a set number of hours per day. I do think the flexi time, no matter what the job is, should become more of a thing. I think there's always an assumption that we would lie in bed and eat pizza and watch Friends. I mean, most people would be motivated to work, would love their work and want to advance in their career, but they would similarly be able to find more time to go to the school plays, catch up on life admin. I mean, when do 9-to-5 people go to the bank? Those little things, I think, can have a massive impact. And I mean, as for the dossers, well, they're going to doss no matter where they are or what they're doing. Now, I'm not a business owner, so maybe it would have more of an impact. But I did hear a company in Galway who've introduced a four-day working week be interviewed, and it had had a really positive effect on them. It hadn't affected them majorly or financially, and they found that their staff were more productive. So in today's age of technology, surely we can give employees a little bit more flexibility. Let us know your thoughts. You can text 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I am at Claire's Lair. Now, all this week on News Talk, we are celebrating National Parents Week in association with Parent Line. And one of the topics that certainly concerns most parents at the beginning seems to be breastfeeding. We actually haven't covered the topic on the show as of yet, so I'm delighted to be joined now by Professor Afif Al Kavash, who's a consultation neonatologist and lactation consultant in the Rotunda. And I'm also joined by Stephanie Buckley, who is a blogger. Hello, how are you? You're both very welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So can we start with you, Afif, if that's okay? And what are the figures like in Ireland for breastfeeding at the moment?
Overall, we don't compare well with the rest of Europe. And, you know, we're met with a lot of challenges in trying to encourage families to take up breastfeeding. I mean, at the moment, we're looking at about only 50% of mothers leaving the hospital are breastfeeding their babies. And that figure falls significantly by 6 months. So we're the lowest breastfeeding nation in Europe at the moment.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting. When there's such a focus on family here in Ireland, it's a really big deal to us. And again, like when I first started presenting this show, one of the first things I said to introduce myself was that this show was never going to be this is how you should live your life. And there's something about breastfeeding that just gets people's hackles up, this idea that this is the best thing you can do for your baby. And if you don't breastfeed, you're not doing the best thing. Is that where the controversy starts, do you think?
I think we as healthcare providers and those that advocate breastfeeding are partly responsible for the low breastfeeding rate, and that you're right. We pitch it as an either or thing, in that you're either breastfeeding your child or you're a failure as a parent. And there's obviously no right way to feeding and looking after your baby that would suit all families. So the best way to feed your baby is a way that would actually encourage you to have a bonding experience and encourage you to be able to still function as a person for yourself, still function as a person within your family. And we can't use breastfeeding to define early parenthood or early motherhood. And I think if we actually take a step back and pitch breastfeeding as something that is obviously beneficial and we should all aspire to try and increase the breastfeeding rates. If families are unable to breastfeed, if mothers are unable to breastfeed for whatever reason, it is not the end of the world, and it is not what defines early breastfeeding, the early relationship. And also, we do not support mothers either antenatally before they have their baby, in the early newborn period in the hospital, or also in the first few weeks after discharge. And the reason I believe we have very low breastfeeding rates is the lack of support that the mothers receive. It is pitched as the most natural thing in the world. And already that kind of labels it as something that mothers should be able to do from the start without help and without support. And that is not true. I mean, I come across so many mothers that actually are trying their best to breastfeed their children, to breastfeed their babies, and we don't actually give them the support in the early newborn period.
Yeah, and we'll come back to what that can be now in a moment, but I want to bring Stephanie in now. Stephanie, your blog is Eat Sleep Chic. Yeah. And tell us a little bit about you and your family.
Okay, so about my breastfeeding journey?
Who have you
my
got in your family?
My dad actually approached the idea. So the first thing my dad said to me when he found out I was pregnant was, "Are you going to breastfeed?" And I initially thought, in my head, I didn't say it out loud, I was like, no way, I'm not doing that.
And were you breastfed?
No, I wasn't breastfed. No. So after then, my first appointment in the rotunda, the midwife, she just, you know, she spoke about breastfeeding and the benefits and the antibodies, the nutrients, the first feed. And then I started to think about it myself. And I was like, do you know what? Actually, I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to try to give it a go. So I knew that it would be difficult. Like, I knew that it doesn't work for every woman and it can be hard. And I kind of went in with that idea that I wanted to do it, but I knew I mightn't be able to do it. So that's kind of how I came to the decision.
And you have a baby at the moment. You were actually at that same spa day with me this week, and I saw you there getting ready for the dinner, pumping away. Yeah. The pump was there. So, I mean, it does really impact on the mum's life.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it was really tough. It's been a roller coaster, you know, there's ups and downs to it. Like, I love the closeness and the bonding, but it took me a few months to actually really get into the hang of it, you know, like with trying to get the latch was really difficult. So in the rotunda, the midwives, if I asked questions, I asked for help, like I didn't know what I was doing. So they came over, they manually latched Phoenix onto me, and it took about 3 days. It was actually the morning that I was discharged that I got the latch. Now, if I hadn't have got it, I don't know if I would have been able to continue at home, because obviously, like, you just want to feed your baby. So, like, even in the rotunda, I did give Phoenix, I think it was 3 Aptamil bottles, just because I was finding it so difficult to get the latch. So the colostrum was coming in. So I had a little bottle and I collected my colostrum, and then we used the syringe to feed Phoenix twice. So one of the midwives, Niamh, she helped me with that. And then she suggested, she was like, look, if you want, you can syringe feed Phoenix, and then you can use an Aptimel bottle, like, just to make sure that he's getting his feeds. So I did do that. But each time the midwives came around, they'd ask, are you still trying to breastfeed? And I said, yeah, can you give me a hand? And they'd be like, right, come back to you in a minute. If they were available, they'd help me then and there. If not, I'll come back to you in a minute and I'll give you a hand. And that's how I got it, like, just by asking for the help.
You do need the help. My friend is a nurse, so I breastfed the two of my babies. But as I said to you both outside, I do have a lot of reservations about that and the impact that it had on me, on my husband, on our family. I loved it. I mean, I cried knowing each one was the last feed. And yet I did find it was like an extension of the pregnancy, and that in itself brings other things with it. So if I have friends that say it hasn't worked out, I'm like, listen, high five. You've tried it. Yeah. You did your best. Now you can just get on with your life and you don't have to do every night feed. That's kind of how I am about it. Afif, let's talk about the support in the hospital. So one of my friends is a nurse, and she said, when you're in the hospital, just ring that bell. They are really busy. They are really understaffed, but they'll come to you and they will help you, and just keep asking for that help, because you are terrified. It is it is a lot. It is painful at the start. That's something nobody really talks about. For the first second, it is quite painful, and then it gets easier. So what about something that was said to Stephanie, and I've heard it said to a lot of mums, you've a hungry baby, you're going to need bottles. Why are we still saying that to mums?
I mean, that's is something that we actually need to rectify. Babies naturally feed every 1 to 2 hours for the first, you know, God knows how long. They actually, they say that babies actually feed every 1 to 2 hours for the first 3 to 4 days, but that can actually be a little bit longer. And that's all automatically assumed that I actually don't have enough milk or my baby is too hungry. But we find that if you actually counsel mothers before they have the baby to warn them that this is what's going to happen for the first few days, it doesn't mean that you're not making enough milk. It doesn't mean that the baby is too hungry. I find that being prepared for what to expect can help a lot. The reason for that is for the first couple of days, mums only make small amounts of milk very often. So the babies only take, you know, small snacks, and breast milk stays in the stomach for a very short period of time, and it kind of digests very quickly. So babies get hungry again very quickly. And that's a natural process until the more mature milk comes in. So, I mean, to answer your question, is babies aren't very hungry. That is their natural way of feeding for the first few days. And if it is tough, I mean, there's no sugarcoating it. It is quite tough. It is quite challenging. You've just had a baby, you're exhausted, and now you're expecting to feed your baby every 1 to 2 hours for the next 3 to 4 days. So it's, I mean, you know, hats off for mums. They're all superheroes for being able to do that.
6 weeks for every 2 hours for 6 weeks for me with Phoenix.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? And I mean, you've just been pregnant. You know, you've just given birth, and it's in the labour ward that you're first expected to latch on, and you're trying to just come to terms with the fact. I mean, it wasn't like a movie for me. You know the way in the movies, the man and the woman just look at the baby and they're like, it's a boy, and they're crying. I was like, what just happened there? I don't even know if I love this baby yet. Am I supposed to feel love? I don't know what I feel. And then they're like, now we're going to latch the baby on. It was mad. I remember being back in the labour ward and nearly begging my son not to wake up because I wouldn't know. I mean, he looked so gorgeous, don't get me wrong. But I remember just thinking, please don't wake up because I won't know what to do with you. So it is an absolutely mad time. But in the same way, it is very natural and very normal. I mean, carrying a person in your tummy is mad anyway, so you may as well get on board the mad train, because it's all that way, and things do just happen. And once you get it, it's very handy, isn't it, because there's no sterilizing bottles, there's no bringing loads of stuff with you. You're a portable feeding machine.
Exactly. But it does, like, for me, you know, I think it took about 4 months to kind of to get it, do you know what I mean? Because when I came home, then the milk came in, so that changed the consistency, changed everything altogether. Phoenix then, I had, the flow was too heavy, so he'd feed and then he'd get sick, so I had to pace feed. So then it was like a minute on one breast, burp him, a minute on the, you know, left to right. So it was kind of a really long process, and that lasted a couple of weeks. But you were saying with the pain, the nipples. That was two weeks. I'd say it lasted 2 weeks and then it was gone.
And nobody talks about that. Yeah, nobody really talks about that. So I think a lot of people might go, oh no, it's not for me, it's hurting me. Whereas if everyone put their hands up and said
the pain ends.
Like, yeah.
It only lasts about 2 weeks. And then once you get through that, it's gone.
It's gone.
So if you knew that, you could say, right, this is, you know, I knew because I asked, like, you know, how long is this meant to last? Or is this right? What's happening here? Like, if you have to ask questions. If you don't ask, you don't know. So that's another part of it. Like, you know.
And I suppose, lucky enough, we have online now and people sharing. Yeah. So maybe there's more information out there. How far away are we from having that support, that everybody does a breastfeeding course, that wants to, and that afterwards, I mean, I had a lactation consultant come to my house that I paid for privately, because you're just doubting yourself because you've no idea what milk they're getting. You're no idea if you're doing the right thing. You're still struggling to get the latch.
There's
how far away are we?
The HSE run complimentary breastfeeding classes because I attended. We were going on a holiday and I wanted to know when I could pump and, you know, how to pump. So in my local community centre in Donabate, I think it's every Thursday, a group of women, there was probably 20 women, all breastfeeding moms in the class, and a lactation consultant is on duty. And that's complimentary, like the HSE run that. So.
But that's at the time where you need to be ready to get up, get into the car, be dressed,
exactly,
meet other people.
Feel like you want to leave the house. Yeah,
I mean, that's amazing because every single other mum is there in the same boat, and
exactly,
there's nothing more supportive than other mums for you saying, oh my God, yours does that, and what about this, and I'm not as bad as she is, or I'm not as good as she is, or whatever
it's
it is.
The chat with the moms, that's kind of, you take the most from that, like comparing your experiences and talking about it.
Yeah, that is your lifeblood as a new mum. But what do you think, Afif, with us in Ireland, is it going to take too much investment to give mums that choice?
I think we're getting much better in the antenatal information and the antenatal classes, and there is good community support if you look for it. I think where we still need to work on is the crucial few days that mum spends in the hospital. Just to put it in context, we now have one midwife looking after up to 10 mum baby pairs on our postnatal wards because we're so understaffed. In other OECD countries, you don't have more than a ratio of 1-4, meaning one midwife looking after four, sometimes looking after only one or two. And that would be the norm in a lot of the other countries. So if you think about it, if this poor midwife that's looking after 10 mothers spends 15 minutes with each midwife, I mean,
with each new mom teaching her
to breastfeed.
Sorry,
with each new mom.
Yeah.
She doesn't have time. He or she doesn't have time to do anything else.
Yeah.
So we actually lack resources. We lack staff to help support the mothers in the early
newborn. And that's where the stats come from. I want to get to some of the texts because we've loads of texts. Mums are awake hours at this stage, I'd say. Laura in Kerry says, I was a first-time mum 2 years ago. I had a C-section. My milk never came in after having my baby. I had no choice but to bottle feed. I was so upset about this in the hospital. It was very obvious. I was devastated. I received no help or support before I left the hospital, which I have no doubt led me to having postnatal depression. The emotional support from the midwives or doctors was non-existent. I felt so alone. I think, Afif, as you say, it just comes down to resources. I'd say every single person there, if they heard that, would have loved to have helped you. But just, we're so busy. What is it a case that sometimes the milk doesn't come in? And again, Laura, we're not placing any blame or judgment in your direction whatsoever. It sounds like you did the absolute best you could.
I'm really sorry for Laura's experience. And to be honest with you, that's one of the reasons I decided to become a lactation consultant, is because I felt that part of my care was deficient before embarking on this course. So it's slowly getting better. There's a lot of reasons why milk doesn't come in the early newborn period. And we know that mums that have cesarean section, the milk can be slightly delayed. But also if there are things like retained placenta in mum for a period of time, if there's increased bleeding around the time of delivery, all these factors can actually reduce the chances of milk happening. What we need to get better at is to actually anticipate this beforehand and target mothers that are at risk of having low milk supply in the early newborn period and really spend extra time working with them to get them to actually improve their supply, because you can actually rein it in. But obviously with the lack of resources, that can be difficult. And that's probably why Laura had this unfortunate experience.
We have Mary who's texted in. She says, I work as a public health nurse. I find very often mums are coming home from hospital with breastfeeding issues, being given unnecessary supplementation of formula and coming home. Pumping mums should be given the chance to get their feeding more established prior to coming home. And we did talk a little bit about that and how really that shouldn't go on unless that's what the mum chooses to do. My daughter-in-law had a baby in Amsterdam, says another. After leaving hospital, a retired teacher came 5 days a week to help her with the baby. Why can't we look at best practice in other countries? This sounded fantastic. Again, we've talked about that and it comes down to resources and the government putting investment in this area. Desmond in Dublin says, please cease referring to Irish mothers as mum. In the UK, this is the term. In the USA, it's mom. In Ireland, it's ma'am, ma or mother. Desmond in Dublin. Desmond, I think it's just different for everyone. I say mum. I always
mom.
Have.
You say mom.
Do you? You say mom. Yeah, we did as kids and then I kind of changed it to mum. But yeah, okay. Ma'am is the universal Irish. Ma'am, all of them, that's who we're talking about, mother.
Yeah, my wife is mum at home as well, unfortunately, sorry.
Yeah. I don't know why, I never said, but my husband says ma'am, it's just one of those things. And Maria in Galway says, how can any woman be expected to have a baby constantly latched on, particularly if she has other children? I think it's totally overrated. Babies all do the same anyway, whether it's bottle or boob, and new mothers have enough to deal with anyway. Now, I raised this with you both, in fact, outside, and one of the things when I look back at myself is I completely gave myself over to breastfeeding at the detriment sometimes of my marriage, my family, myself and my time away. Like I didn't take nights away. I didn't do all of these things. And yet you build that in, Stephanie. You made
definitely.
That happen.
Definitely. We went on holidays, my partner and I, we went away for 9 nights. We went to Miami and the Bahamas. I pumped 260 ounces before I left. So I pumped around the clock, but I had a break then. Like I went away.
Stephanie, I'm loving your life.
Then I went on two hens, which I also
pumped for. What age was the baby?
So Phoenix was 4 months when we first went away.
Right.
Now I did cry.
Missed him.
Yeah, but I had a ball. Like
yes,
I had a great time.
Yes.
Like I knew when I was over there, I was like, right, well, I'm not going home, so I'm going to enjoy it.
And actually at that age, you know, they're quite happy whoever they're
exactly.
with, and they're in such a routine that once that's kept up.
They don't
up,
really know the difference.
That's the best time to be leaving them.
Yeah.
And there is a myth out there, isn't there, Afif, that we can't do anything. I mean, even having a drink from time to time is okay when you're breastfeeding.
Absolutely. I mean, you lose your body autonomy for 9 months when you're carrying this baby that's basically sucking the life out of you for 9 months. And then you deliver and you think, finally, I'm getting my body back. And then people say, oh, hang on, you're breastfeeding. You can't drink. You can't go out. You can't have more than one cup of coffee a day. You can't eat this. You can't eat that.
Dads can't do night feeds.
Dads can't do night feeds. You know, I'm sure all dads around encourage breastfeeding.
They love it.
My husband encouraging pregnant couples.
Absolutely.
Get her to breastfeed. Yeah. It's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's partly why this misinformation is partly why a lot of mums decide not to take on breastfeeding, because of the perceived huge impact it has. And Stephanie is a brilliant example of how you can actually breastfeed and still get your life back in the early newborn period. It is absolutely fine to have the odd drink, provided you, you know, take some safe measures. And there's brilliant resources on the HSE website, breastfeeding.ie, to actually outline exactly how you can drink safely during pregnancy. So it is very doable. You know, breast milk actually filters a lot of toxins, so you don't have to worry too much about what you eat. You don't have to worry too much about how many cups of coffee you take a day. You know, 2 or 3 cups of coffee are actually fine when you're breastfeeding as well. So I find that if mothers realize that, if we as healthcare providers provide them with that information and help support them earlier on, you'll find that breastfeeding rates will go up.
Well, we obviously need to keep talking about this. We can't do so on this occasion, but I thank you both very much for coming in. Professor Afif El-Kafash, who's consultation neonatologist and lactation consultant in the Rotunda, and Stephanie Buckley, who you'll find at Eat Sleep Chic. Thank you both very, very much for coming in.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
So Dublin Vitality Expo is on in Dublin, and heading up the fitness and yoga stage is Claire McGrath. Now, Claire is the first and only female Irish IFBB professional fitness athlete. I'll ask her a little bit about that now. And she describes herself as obsessed with all things health and wellness. And she joins me in studio now. Hello, Claire.
Hi, Claire.
I know. Well, you're with the eye, I'm without.
Yes.
And you're with the abs, and I am without. But we'll leave that aside for now. And tell me about that title and what exactly it means.
It's a the IFBB is the biggest and the best bodybuilding stage in the world. So it's the best federation. Basically, it's a prestigious bodybuilding federation. So that title is very much sought after in the bodybuilding world. So to become a pro is the top of the game, basically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we'll come back to that in a moment. Take me back, though, to how all of this started. I mean, were you very sporty and fit at school?
Yeah, I've always been into some form of sport. And whatever that sport is, I've always been obsessed with it. So I've been a breakdancer, a gymnast. I did Irish dancing for 17 years, badminton champion, like silly unusual things, I would say, not silly, but just different sports. And then I got into yoga. I had a really bad breakdancing injury and I had to rehab my knee. And I just found yoga when I moved to Dublin and got really into Ashtanga yoga and did that only for 6 years, 3 hours a day, really intense Ashtanga practice. Went to India, became a yoga teacher, all of that. And then I kind of found that I was getting instability injuries because I did too much yoga. So it was very biased towards flexibility and all of that. I felt amazing, but felt like I was missing something on the strength side. So then I got into CrossFit, became a CrossFit competitor, all in on CrossFit, injured my back. And then I discovered bodybuilding. And the reason I connected with the fitness category is when I was about 15, I used to watch this thing called Miss Fitness USA on TV. It was on Eurosport really late at night. And I used to copy the girls' moves. And they were these incredibly fit looking women doing crazy gymnastic kind of strength power moves, handstands, flips. And me being a gymnast, I really looked up to them. And when I found out about the bodybuilding industry in Ireland and that the fitness category was actually what I was watching when I was 15, it was straight away going, I need to do that. Very connected to it from a very young age, but not knowing that that was bodybuilding. I was just impressed by what the women could do. So I picked a show. It was 9 weeks away from it. I've never done really any extreme diet like that. I've always been into, like, I used to be vegan. I've been into loads of different types of diets.
And sounds like when you go for something, you really go full tilt.
Yeah. So I went straight for a show and straight on a diet, very strict. Wasn't really used to being that strict with my food, but it was a new challenge. So I went all in on it and I did really well in my first show. And then I took a bit of an off season. I wasn't sure if I was going to compete again. And I just decided that if I didn't go for it, like give it another shot, that I'd never do it. So I just wanted to keep my options open because I really enjoyed it. And so I decided to do another season and then I just started winning and I won the national title in Ireland. And then I went to compete abroad, which wasn't really done at the time, but I had an opening to do it. So I just went for it. So I won Amateur Olympia in the UK as a rookie. No one knew who I was. It was kind of unusual for someone to win when they've never seen you before, but it was one of those. I put everything into, we do like a dance gymnastic strength performance on stage as well as posing. So I put everything into the performance. It was a little bit of my yoga, my breakdancing, my gymnast, like everything all together. And then I didn't get my pro card on that day. I should have, but I didn't know anything about it at that time and politics and all of that. I wasn't given it then, but I was told to do another show international and win that. And then I would get my pro card. So I picked Arnold's in South Africa. So Arnold Schwarzenegger does a series of shows all around the world. And I went to South Africa because I'd never been there. So I literally picked probably the furthest away show I could.
And is Arnie himself there?
Yeah. He gives out the prizes when you win. So yeah, it was amazing. And I went with one of my friends and there was no one else there. And I won that. So got my pro card. I was awarded later that year. And I haven't done a pro debut because actually since, I kind of go all in on something and tick all the boxes and get what I want from it, enjoy the process. It's really important for me to enjoy the process. And since then, I've kind of realized that bodybuilding and that world is quite extreme. To be in that shape, like to get that lean for stage is quite intense. And it's not something that you should really do for a long time because you push your body really to the limit. And I wasn't really enjoying it as much as I could have been. So for me, that's a sign that I need to do something else. So
because you do have to put your life on hold, don't mm-hmm. you? I mean, you're not going for dinner as often with friends.
Yeah.
You can't go to a family celebration.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting everything into that. And for me, that wouldn't be sustainable.
No. And it is when that's your goal. Like my goal was to get the pro card and I actually was working against myself for probably about a year trying to do a pro debut, but I just wasn't aligned with it because I kind of felt like I had done that whole world, and I wanted something different that was more back towards wellness and yoga and listening to my body. And like, I feel like I have to do every extreme to understand where the balance is. So I've been to the yoga world where nobody even takes a selfie because it's so internal. It's such a practice for yourself. It's so about wellness and health and all of that. It's not about visual, that I went to the complete opposite, which is bodybuilding. Look at me, I'm in great shape on stage, prancing around like in a bikini. Great fun, but like total opposite worlds. Loads of photos, loads of selfies. And I think it's okay to play in both worlds to really get a feel for what balance is. And now I know what balance is for me. And it's really listening to my body, not being too hard on myself in any sense. Too much yoga, too much bodybuilding, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. I always say this, I teach balance workshops now. They're like yoga, handstands. Like, handstands are kind of my thing. I do a lot of handstands.
You're a handstand champion, aren't you? You're not even giving yourself a full credit. How do you get to be a handstand champion?
I don't know. Handstands have always been part of my life. So it's just a skill that I honed in on for the fitness competitions. And to be good at handstands is really mastering a skill. And I just really like it. It's like a form of meditation. You have to focus on what you're doing or you just fall out of it. So for me, it was really like that attention control and like that obsessive, I got to get it, try again. So now they're almost natural. It's almost more natural for me to be on my hands than not. So I have to like resist sometimes from doing them in places I shouldn't.
And how long can you stay in a handstand for?
I've held one for over 2 minutes. I can walk around. I can do different tricks. I can do handstands on stilts. Just loads of different kind of fun, like how can I make a handstand more challenging? I kind of find ways to scare myself by like doing them on the edge of a cliff or, you know, something a bit daredevil-y.
So what about life now then as a professional athlete? Does that mean that you don't have a 9-to-5 job on the side, that bodybuilding is your life?
I wouldn't say any one thing is my life. I actually have a lot of things going on. I'm a creative director as well. So I went to college to study design. That's where I found breakdancing and yoga and all of those things. And so I'm a really creative person. So I do a lot of design work for a vegan, gluten-free bread company called Be Free. And yeah, they're just, I've been with them for years. And that's like, it's not full time. So my life is very mixed. I also do personal stretching with people. Very intimate one-on-one yoga kind of helping people move better, basically, and helping them connect to their own strengths and weaknesses and identifying where they are and stuff. So it's really a tailored kind of yoga, but on a very like teaching people how to breathe and how to feel what's going on in their body.
And work with their own limitations. Yeah. Somebody's going to be more flexible than the other. Mm-hmm. So one-on-one is really important.
Yeah. And I might get someone that has, like, I have a client that has really bad asthma, teaching him how to breathe differently. Or I might get someone who just wants to learn handstands. You know, so there's a really big variety of like someone really needs help and they need help with their body and managing themselves and their energy, or someone who just wants to learn something fun. So I get a nice mixture of kind of different people.
And with your training then, how full on is it? What's a week in your life like?
At the moment, like when I was bodybuilding, it was very full on. I would train twice a day. It would be cardio in the morning before I eat anything. And that would be every day. And then I would do a weight session later on in the day. And then I would be practicing my fitness routine. So maybe 3 times a day sometimes. And it's not really, when to get in that kind of shape, yes, you need to be able to train. But I had such a foundation of training already that I went straight on a diet. So I didn't really build my muscles bodybuilding. I built them with all of the things that I'd done all of my life. So my body was a culmination of all of that, not the training that I did.
Not the 9 weeks only.
No, exactly. And then after that, I was more bodybuilding focused. So I was able to change my shape. And it was really interesting to see how, if you are specific with your training, you can change your shape to something completely different. But for me, it was diet. So to get in that shape for bodybuilding, like it doesn't matter what training you do, you have to diet. And the diet's super strict. And I did enjoy it. Like, I enjoyed the whole process of being really strict, that discipline. And it's almost empowering to feel like you're completely in control of your diet.
Yeah.
And you feel good.
If you like to set yourself a target and achieve it, this is a really condensed way of doing it. Plus, you're seeing the results in your body.
Yeah, exactly. And it's when you start to see the results that it really pays off. It becomes easier to stick to it. So the diet's super clean. It, like, clean as in like really plain turkey, plain chicken, green vegetables. Didn't really do many carbs because that was just how my body wanted to do things. Everyone diets differently. I didn't really take many supplements. There's a few supplements that I couldn't do without. And actually, I got into, like, I'm a very big believer in getting nutrition from your food. But when you do bodybuilding, you cut out a lot of micronutrients. I wasn't having fruit. There's vitamins that I was lacking. So I take my Altrian C, which is like a vitamin C liposomal form. And I used to get vitamin IVs maybe twice, three times a year. They're quite expensive, but I felt like a lot of supplements that you ingest, you don't really get a lot from it. So the IV vitamins, it goes straight into your blood. It super saturates your blood. So you actually absorb it and your body uses it and it thinks it needs it because it's in your bloodstream. They've invented this really smart thing that mimics that called liposomal. So Altrian, the ones that I take, they are liposomal. So they are encapsulated so that they go straight into your gut wall and they're not broken down by your stomach. So they really mimic the same effect as a vitamin IV. And I actually feel the same after taking them that I would if I got a boost from an IV. So that's like the one thing that I always add in if I am doing a diet. It just keeps me kind of stable, my energy stable, keeps me healthy, no colds and flus.
And what is on your goal list then for the future?
At the moment, I have a few different projects going on with different people, and on body image and like a post show and how people struggle. One of my really good friends in the UK, Rosie Rascal, she's an ex-IFBB pro as well. We want to set up a business together about, and it's going to be online and it's going to empower females' body confidence, give them tools, tips and tricks, online help, support, create a community of like, almost, it's not necessarily just female, but we feel like it probably will end up being female empowering, and just how to give control back to people. So I feel like people are always looking for coaches. They're looking for people to tell them what to eat, how to train. Actually, they know themselves what they should be doing if they really listen. So for me, that's been a massive learning. I have all of the answers if I really listen to what I want to do. So we're setting something up that we can help people, especially post-competitors, recover body image-wise, get back to normal life, people who don't want to compete anymore, or just people who struggle in general with eating disorders, like all of that. So we're going into, we feel like really it's a purpose more than a business, but it will probably end up being a business that has just massive purpose for us.
Well, you're a very impressive individual, I have to say. Your abs are only one part of what impresses me about you.
Thank you
so much for talking to me today. You can catch Claire on the fitness and yoga stage at the Vitality Expo in Dublin. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Alive and kicking on Newstalk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
Now, this week on News Talk, we have teamed up with the Bank of Ireland to focus on youth financial well-being. And on today's show, we're taking a look at practical tips on how to alleviate and manage financial stress on families. Dr. Mark Harold is a clinical psychologist and author of Coping with Stress, and he joins me now in studio. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Claire.
The finances are something that, whether we like it or not, we all have to deal with. So once we fly the nest, we're in charge of balancing our own books, and things can go horribly wrong.
Certainly. Well, like in the last, say, 15 years, when we went from biggest boom ever to biggest bust ever, they were both circumstances that Irish people never encountered before. So that was a unique set of stressors, if you like. And all of a sudden, things became important, such as, you know, what kind of car you drove, how many bedrooms you had, and, you know, what kind of watch you wore. And I believe that was very unnatural for Ireland. And it created an almost expectation for the people who were buying these things, but also then for the next generation, which is the generation which is coming through now.
But there was also an air of, you know, borrow it, don't worry about it, there's plenty of it out there. And then all of a sudden, that was just taken away. And even now for our young people coming up, there is this air of, you might not necessarily get to do what you really want to in life, mm-hmm. because the jobs might not be there, or with with Brexit, there might be another crash, and it's all this kind of negativity. So how detrimental can financial stress be on a person?
Well, I think it's quite significant. I just recall my son, when he was about six, saying to me, "Do you know something, Dad?" He says, "Money doesn't make you happy. It's what you buy with it that does." And there is that, that expectation didn't ever ever change. And it does have to be, addressed. I mean, the one thing I would say is that we never had an outlet for the anger after the bust. You know, the casino bankers walked off into the sunset and we never protested. That was a major source of stress, in my estimation, for society across the board. Having addressed that, or having acknowledged that, we haven't addressed it, having acknowledged that, there are a number of things that people need to do. And one of the things I think that didn't happen, and I think this is what led to a lot of the, sadly, numerous suicides that we're all aware of that happened post, bust, was that we didn't, one of the stress strategies that we actually need to adopt is face our fears, step in and address it. And I mean, in that circumstance, it would have been to go speak to banks, speak to financial advisors, speak to credit unions, speak to people, people who knew what they were talking about. And a lot of people didn't do that. So they were out, they were sucked in, buying all their big cars on credit and all the other trappings that go with it. But then once they didn't have it, they didn't address those. And that led to huge stresses. And one of the things that actually happened was that people felt that they were the only one, that they were going to lose faith if they ever, if they were ever called out on their debt. And I mean, let's face it, just about every household in Ireland was struggling.
Because I think, we bury our heads in the sand when it comes to finances. And even if you haven't borrowed to the hilt, there's a lot of people who just say, "I'm just not earning enough money. So money runs out at the end of the month. There's no point in me looking into it. There's no point in me spending time writing down all my outgoings and all my incomings and seeing if I can make a difference." Whereas if you do, you can. And I've been guilty of it myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no question. And another thing that I find, I mean, I've been given this course called Stress Control. Myself and a colleague, Dr. Alison Rooney, gave it out in Malahide, where I'm from. We had people coming in their hundreds to courses in the Grand Hotel in Malahide during that sort of bust time when there was huge stresses around. But one of the things we tell them is, we were telling the people, 95% of what we worry about never happens. So all these fears of catastrophe and shame don't actually happen. So that's why it was important to sort of face fears. And then some of the strategies that we need to adopt. One is the way we talk to each other, for instance. And not talk to each other for sure, but the way we talk to ourselves.
Yeah.
Because often we'll call ourselves names that we'd never call our worst enemies.
Yeah.
And what a failure we were and how bad we were. And that's a really important thing.
And we do place a huge amount of significance on financial success and assume that all these people living in the big houses with the big cars and the money in the bank are really happy. Whereas, sometimes it's the person who's renting the one bed studio with hardly a penny to their name is far happier.
Well, absolutely. And it's all about perspective, because there is no such thing as reality. It's our interpretation of what's actually out there. For instance, which would you prefer, a major illness or a major debt? Well, I think most of us would go for a major debt. But when we're in the middle of it, we actually don't think about that. So it's really important that, we actually face up to the fears and then do something realistic about it. Now, in terms of stress, there's lots of things that people can do. I mean, and they know about them. For instance, you have to get moving. I mean, you were talking about the bodybuilder yoga person, but you don't have to be a professional to do it. But exercise is the number one best de-stressor of all.
Yeah, get yourself out for a walk.
Get out there, absolutely. Another one that's really, really important, Claire, and this is people don't fully realise this is how we breathe. Breathing is huge. So if we learn simple breathing techniques, we can avoid panic attacks. What actually happens is our heart sends 60 times more messages to the brain than the brain does to the heart. If we can actually get our heart under control, then we're going to actually send a message to the brain, everything is fine. And so the brain is going to send out the hormones that are going to make us relax, the serotonins, the oxytocins. But when we have our heart rate is up, then we're producing cortisol, which puts us on alert, makes us nervous. What do we do in contemporary age, in our contemporary age now, is we drink copious amounts of coffee or tea.
Because we're not sleeping at night. We're worrying about our bills and our finances. And then we're up in the morning and we're fueling ourselves with caffeine.
And so we get into that cycle. So we actually know the solutions to our stresses. But we actually need to take concrete steps to do them. So, look, there's no doubt about it. Caffeine is a big cause of stress in contemporary society. And another sort of strategy that I would suggest that people actually adopt is to develop an attitude of gratitude. We've become so competitive about what we don't have that we actually need to stop and say, look, we have an awful lot. Can you imagine if you lived in somewhere like Syria? Believe it or not, 15 years ago, I travelled through Syria on my own, getting taxis and buses, going through Aleppo.
A very beautiful city.
Beautiful families, beautiful cities, you know, gorgeous people. And can you imagine?
And now it's just reduced to rubble.
Oh, absolutely. It's so sad. But if we stop and
compare yourself to that.
What have we got?
You might not have an Audi in the driveway, but you're healthy, you're happy, you have your family. And just flick that switch in your brain, because it does have a major impact. And I think what you've said there not only impacts on financial stress, but any stresses we have.
Absolutely.
And it's very simple things we can do involving changing our thought patterns, getting out for exercise and breathing. Thank you very, very much for coming in. Do you have any of those classes coming up?
There's nothing planned just at the moment, but people should keep an eye in the newspapers.
And you do have your book, Coping with Stress, Dr. Mark Harold, clinical psychologist. You had one last thing that you just want to say. We won't have time to get into it, but what is it?
I was going to say that as a professional, I earn my living doing problem solving, and there's 6 simple steps to problem solving.
Okay, well, maybe people could go to your website to find out that. Is that all right?
Thank you very much
for coming on. I really do appreciate it. And my thanks to my producers this week, John Fardy and Claire Darmody. My researcher was Elaine Power, and Jojo Cordozo was on sound.